Check 1, 2, check 1, 2. Guys, hey, welcome. This is Forging the Path. It's a podcast that's all about empowering men to become who God created us to be. My name is Adam. I'm so grateful that you have tuned in. In this episode, I talk with my friend and colleague, Michael Creed. Michael Creed is an awesome husband and father and friend, but he is also a business owner. Luminate Home Loans, the Michael Creed team. He's a sponsor of our show, and he's got a lot of wisdom to share about finances. If you have not already heard the episode from right around New Year's, I think it's December 31st of 2023, about 5 months ago, go back to that. We talk about habits and disciplines, especially in the four areas of faith, family, fitness, and finances. And Michael is an expert at this stuff. In this episode today, we focus specifically on finances and we go deep. And I try and get as much advice and practical wisdom out of Michael as possible. He's got a lot to offer. I'm going to share some resources with you in the show notes as well. Enjoy the show. Michael, we're going to dive right in. The first question I wanted to ask you, you can take this any direction you want to, but there's a lot of misconceptions about money. What is the biggest misconception people have, especially a guy like you working in finance and lending all day, every day? What's the biggest conception people have?
The biggest one that I've seen personally in my life is that money buys happiness, that money buys security. In the world, you know, when we're talking to clients and doing what we do in the mortgage space, it's all over the place. I don't know that, you know, and especially today with the younger generations, that they even have any idea of what money's really for. There's a very, very clear mindset challenge that we're combating in the industry right now, and particularly with millennials. You know, and let's define that real quick. I'm 45, I'll be 46 this year. I'm only 2 years away from being a millennial. So millennials are not high schoolers. Or
you're a Gen Xer, though.
I'm a Gen Xer, right, there's no doubt. But, you know, I really believe that especially Gen Xers and baby boomers and, you know, those that are my age and older think that millennials are still like 20 years old. They're not. They're in their 40s at this point, right? And so having an understanding of that is a big deal. And the Gen Zers, which Gen Zers are even adults at this point, that goes up to 27 years old as of the time of this recording. And most of us, even myself included, our kids are Gen Zers as well. But that there's just so literal literacy, financial literacy in Gen Z and millennials in particular, that they don't even have an idea of what money really is other than that they just need it. So it's kind of an undefined misconception, if that makes sense. And that could very well be, just as a percentage of the population, one of the largest misconceptions.
Yeah, well, you posted something a couple months ago on Facebook. We were just talking about it. It was a simple conversation starter. And it said, "What did your parents teach you about money?" Or something along those lines. What were some of the responses that you got, or any of the conversations that came as a result of that post?
It was fascinating, but not surprising at the same time. A few people had gotten some fantastic advice from their parents. Most people had no advice from their parents. So it was either we don't talk about money, like it's hush hush, it's not something we ever talk about, to areas of just, it's bad. Some people were told it was bad, but most people had gotten very little direction about what money is. And that's the reality of it. If you look at what our parents, you know, what generations of parents have taught their children about money, what the education system, especially if they're in the public education system, are teaching their people about money. You know, where you and I both live in the Kettle Moraine School District, for example, here in Wisconsin, and they actually have a personal finance class requirement in high school, which is very rare still today. And even then, what they teach, I mean, it's certainly better than nothing, but to me, it's still super surfacey, you know. And so that when you just look at the level of detail of what it looks like, it's really just the basics of like how to balance a checking account, how to, you know, get us open a savings account, never anything about investing, making your money go further, what, like those kinds of things. It's very, or if anything, it's super servicey. But in that conversation, to your point or to your question, it was very few people had a clear direction of what to do with money. And oftentimes the ones that did, it still wasn't healthy.
Yeah. Well, why do you think it is that so many people seem to answer, "We don't talk about money"?
my gut tells me it's pride. They just don't want to talk about it. Or, the, you know, there's this idea that it's none of anybody else's business what kind of money is available. They don't want their, maybe parents don't, when money's tight, they don't want to tell their kids about the fact that money's tight to keep their kids from feeling insecure, right? I truly believe that a lot of the challenges that everybody has with money is based on the way that parents maybe try to protect their kids from the reality of what money is or what money does. And so it's about, and I think the pride is a big part of it. So they're not necessarily willing to acknowledge the challenges that come sometimes with money. Also don't want to maybe tell the kids that they have a lot of money if they do, because then the kids might think it's theirs. You know, so if you have the conversation around money with a child or with a young adult as a parent, you need to have, you can't just be like, we have this dollars or these are the resources that the Lord has blessed us with, more along the lines of this is what we're going to do with it, this is how we're going to use it. It's and kind of take it from there in a very in-depth way. And then kids don't want to do it. I mean, the last time I talked to my son about money, I made him sit with me for 3 hours as we walked through and updated the budget, you know, moved money around in different places. Like, what is this and why do we do it this way and how are we doing it? And it was all way over his head, you know, because we're talking to high schoolers who might be earning, you know, $10, $15 an hour. And that's to them, a mortgage payment or investing is just doesn't even radar, and they're just not comparable, you know. And they're also making $10 to $15 an hour on a 10 hours a week job, right? So their paychecks are significantly different than a full time professional's compensation would look like, and so they can't really wrap their head around what that looks like. Mm. So, but I think, and we'll get into this a little bit later, I think if we go the approach of not necessarily teaching our finances as a parents to the kids, but also teaching the kids what to do in basic steps with their own finances, with their own numbers, with their own paychecks, can really have a bigger impact in the long run.
Yeah.
And that is probably the biggest issue. We as a society, at least what I see in the circles I run in, is our kids spending money, or our kids working money, is just their spending money. So we're creating a horrible habit right out of the gate.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, you just convicted me a little bit there. And I think, so I've talked with my kids about money, but I need to up my game, because there is that mentality. It's my earning money is my spending money. And that's about it. Now, we encourage our kids, hey, put at least 10% in savings. They all have savings and checking accounts, you know, for various things. And we talk about that on a surface level, but I agree with you that, and here's what I would also add. Any fathers listening, you need to own this.
Mm-hmm.
You need to own. You can't take a passive role in this area. If you have kids, it is your responsibility primarily to begin teaching your kids about money and how to use it as a resource, how to save it, how to give it, what's tithing, like how to budget, how to make your money work for you, invest it, things like that. And all of this is pretty new to me. So that's why I got a guy like Michael on the show. That's why I'm trying to learn from guys who are ahead of me on this, because this only became a conviction for me probably within the last 5 years, 4 years, around COVID, same time a lot of things changed in my life. And I was like, wow, I have some blind spots in my life that I need to take ownership of in a significant way. So I'm glad you're here. And I would just... I would add a yes and an amen. I think parents can step up in this area. Mm. If you have kids, you need to teach them about money, or you need to make sure that someone else is in oversee that and facilitate that opportunity for your kids, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it starts with making sure that we, though, as the parents, have the healthy relationship with money, because we don't want to necessarily teach them our bad habits either.
Ooh, yeah, well said. Well said. So... how can people, second question, this is one of the most asked questions. I'm sure you get this all the time. How can people save more money? Practical ways.
A practical way is to have a budget. That's the way to do it, right? And we'll actually talk about that in a little bit here. But having a budget, if you don't plan for it, it's never going to happen, right? We've all heard if you're not planning, you're failing. If you're failing to plan, you're planning to fail, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the saying.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, that's exactly what this is. Like, you have to have a plan. So, and the budget is the plan. That's what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going into the budget, let's just talk about that for a minute. I mean, you have to have a plan. And for me, it's first things first, just like a lot of things in life. You know, we talked about that in the one that released at the beginning of the year that you mentioned at the front end of this recording as well. First things first with with the daily routine. Well, it's the same thing with finances for me, right? So we've got, and for me, because my income is wildly different from 1 month to the next, right? Because we're in a business ownership perspective, it's commission based, all those kinds of things.
Right.
I don't have a dollar budget. Like I don't know what the number coming in is. So that's a very different budget than someone that knows exactly what the number coming in is every month. Because that way, with a budget like that, if you know exactly what the dollar is coming in each month, if your salary is fixed and it doesn't change, you can start with the end in mind, essentially, in that case, where you know what the final number is, figure out what your priorities are. So, right, so your tithing, your savings, your investments, whatever that looks like, then what your bills are, and then what's ever left over, you know, you can kind of figure that out. Okay. In the case of a variable income, though, you have to, and I've struggled with this for a long time trying to figure it out, and it's like, I don't know why, but when I tell you what it is, it's pretty obvious. You know that whatever your check is going to be 100% of whatever that is, right? And so you really have to have your budget then set as percentages, which can make it really challenging in cases like that. But it's very safe and secure when your percentages on the front end, so your savings, particularly in your investing, are large, so that as long as your bills are being met, the majority of your money is going into the, you know, even if you have a small month, for example, your savings is significant enough that you can rely on that. And so for somebody who's in a variable income, you know, the conventional wisdom would say if you're in a fixed income, you should have 6 months of expenses saved, like total that way. Yeah. I would argue you need more like a year when you're in a variable income situation, because you might fluctuate to 8 months to a year, depending upon where it's at. And with the 6 month one, it's probably a little, you could get close to zero if you have a bad run in your business, you know, for 6 months or whatever that might look like, right? So that's how the budgeting starts, is figuring that out. So first things first, and savings is the biggest one of it. That has to be the top of the budget. I would say the two non-negotiables for me are the savings and the tithing. But if, for example, sometimes if I want to keep the cash flow where it is, I will skip the savings if I'm having a small month, but the tithing doesn't get to get skipped. Like that becomes a hard issue if you're like, well, I had a little check, so whatever. Like, well, no, if your savings is where it needs to be, you rely on that. The Lord provided that in the past so that you can still continue your tithing. Now, your tithe might be small because it's a percentage, right? But it's a percentage.
Yeah.
And it's still the same percentage.
Yeah.
In whether it's, you know, a 10% of $10,000 or 10% of $1,000 is still a percentage, and it's that portion piece. So for me, it's tithes, then savings. And then after that is where the rest of it goes. And if there's leftovers, it still just goes into the savings.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Do you agree? I've heard, first let's start with the tithe. 10%?
Yes. And I use my gross income for that. Now, the difference between that is mainly it doesn't all go to one place. For me, it's 10% to the kingdom, right? So I'm hitting the Christian ministries, of course, our main church as part of it, but also some other ministries that I'm involved with that I have a huge heart for. So, mm-hmm. And that, I don't know. I mean, the Bible's not clear that it has to, that full 10% has to go to one place, but it does go to Christian ministries, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those 10% is actually money that I put specifically in an account that Lynn and I, my wife and I, have control over, that we can help anybody that's in need whenever they need it. And so once in a while, something comes up where we find out, like, I don't want to get too specific, but let's just say we knew somebody that had a family had needed something in their house that was quite expensive, and we were able to roundabout ways without that person knowing provide for that expense because of that savings account. So that 1% we hold back, but it's not our money. It's just waiting for the Lord to put something in front of us that it goes for.
Wow.
And it makes it super easy to do in those situations.
That's beautiful.
So there's a lot of cool stories over the years that I know and the Lord knows and very few others know about how that's happened, you know, through that, because it's really important to us to, like I was sharing with you even offline, to be anonymous in situations like that. I just, it's what I want.
All right, let me take a quick minute and thank all of our sponsors. Thanks, S2F Installation. To all you managers, engineers, or facilities maintenance people out there, if you need some ideas to better manage your warehouse, call my friend Ray at S2F Installation. He can help guide you in the right direction. It's a company designed to serve. 262-470-6882. Thanks, Phantom Creek Builders. Phantom Creek Builders is a premier interior remodeling company that specializes in kitchen and bathroom remodeling as well as finished basements. Find them at phantomcreekbuilders.com. Thanks, Michael Creed team at Luminate Home Loans. Whether you're looking to buy or refinance, there's no one better than the Michael Creed team at Luminate Home Loans. To get a conversation started, text FTP to 262-696-9048. And thank you, Zastro Family Real Estate, powered by Realty Executives Integrity. My wife and I love guiding people to achieving their real estate goals and giving them an amazing experience along the way. Reach out to us today to discuss your real estate goals. You can call or text 262-725-2855. You can also find us online by searching Zastro Family Real Estate. All right, back to the show.
It's interesting with the tithe, because I've talked to Christians who are like, well, that's Old Testament and you don't have to get legalistic about it. And I agree more with where you're coming from. But nevertheless, it's an in-house debate. We can still be Christians and have some disagreement. I look at it like, wait, okay. Like, the Lord gave me 100% of what I got. Mm-hmm. Even if I want to be like, well, I worked hard for it. Well, okay, God gave me the ability to work hard.
Yeah.
Like, he gave me a sharp mind. He gave me an able body. Like, everything I've got, thanks be to God.
Yep.
Right? So he gave me 100%, and all he does is ask for 10 back to things like ministry, kingdom work, church work. Like, okay, that sounds like a great deal. All right. Yes, Lord. And I want to agree with that.
I think one thing to catch in mind too, just in case any of your listeners are in the spot where I was, and we talked about this in the last podcast too, about me being in debt up to my eyeballs when the Lord caught me and my finances that were in a mess because of the way that the housing market had been back in that time, in 2008 when it all fell apart. And so for us, we started differently. We started, I think, at 3% or 4%, and then with a heart of every year going up, because we were tapped out, but nice. We still had to do it, right? Like, and it was like, I have to pay this debt off. And the Lord was very clear, like, yes, but you didn't, you know, if you would have followed these principles that you knew about growing up, that you would have been able to, you wouldn't be in the situation that you're in. And so even though we were snowballing to pay off the debt, you know, snowballing that debt, paying it off that way, we still increased the tithe and got there over time. That was a practical way for me, because there may be somebody hearing this who's like, yeah, I don't have an extra penny right now to be able to do this. So Adam, this whole 10% thing sounds amazing, but it's just impossible. I can't make, unless I get another job, right?
Sure.
Which changes all that. So I think that you're absolutely right. But that the reality is that if there's no savings happening and there's no tithing and the person's currently living paycheck to paycheck, 10% save or 10% tithing in a 6 month reserve is going to be really difficult to come by in that situation. And so that's going to require some bigger heart and life changes to get those resources more in line with what's actually, you know, like the use of the resources coming in line. So that gets a little more complicated, but
yeah.
I know from personal experience that it can be done.
Yeah. Your story is such a testimony to how God will be faithful.
Absolutely.
As you take one step toward him, he takes 10 toward you. It's like,
for sure.
That's awesome. I've seen people who've wrestled and have debated me a little bit on the tithe. I actually love your story, and there's nothing I would say. You started at 3 or 4%, you were saying, with the prayer of going higher and higher every chance you got. Beautiful. Love it. Super encouraged by it. What I've heard some guys say to me is like, yeah, I can't afford to do that tithe, like a true 10%. So I'm only giving, you know, the average giving in American church right now is 2%.
Mm-hmm.
In the Great Depression, it was higher. The average giving of church going Americans in the Great Depression was 2.5 to 3%. Still kind of lousy.
Sure.
But our grandparents, our great grandparents were more generous in the Great Depression with their money than we were, you know? And my grandparents waited in line for lard in Milwaukee in the Great Depression, 7 kids. Like, times were hard.
Yep.
And on average, churchgoers gave more. That makes me sad. And so when I hear people talk about, I can't afford to tithe, but they've got the latest Apple smartphone. They've got the latest Apple Watch. They've got a loan on their car. They've got nice things in their house. I'm like, so the first thing when times get hard that you're willing to cut is the tithe, but all these other things, as a Christian, if you're not a Christian and you're listening to this, then first I would talk about Jesus with you. But if you are in the kingdom, I would be like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, start cutting the other things.
Yeah. Well,
like, don't cut your tithe.
You're right.
You were in a situation where you were paying off massive amounts of debt.
Yep.
First, so that then you could get to a baseline tithe. That's awesome. A lot of people are not even, I'm like, dude, sell your, give your phone back and get a cheaper phone.
Like, yeah.
Sell your car, pay off the loan, and drive a beater around for a couple years.
Yeah, you know? You're absolutely right. You know, and that's, it's exactly get what I was going to say.
Like in other areas, not the tithe.
It's also just think differently, right? So You and I were laughing a little bit. I'm sure laughing that as a 45-year-old, I've the new owner of my first ever iPhone because I've been Android forever and I'm still trying to figure this phone out. But I had to get this for technology that I was using for works got blocked by Google. So it is what it is. Mm. But I bought this phone refurbished for a third of the price of a new one of the same one because I'm not, it's fine. They call it like new condition, refurbed for a third of the price. You know, and so it's about using your thinking differently, right? I didn't go to the Verizon store to Best Buy and buy this. I ordered it through a refurb company and it's perfectly fine. It comes with a warranty and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I travel a lot. People look at that and I mean, I can't tell you how many times people are like, it must be nice. But I do that very differently. I recently went on a pretty cool trip with my wife and I flew on miles. That's why we went where we went, was because I could get there for free, stayed at a friend's house where I paid a super discounted, what she offered. I didn't negotiate. I didn't call the friend and be like, hey, can I stay at your place for free? I was just like, hey, I know you have an Airbnb there. I'd love to use it. She threw a number out at me that I thought was wildly reasonable, probably half of what I would have paid for a hotel,
Nice.
And then she's like, by the way, my car's there. So I'll just have my car guy drop it off at the airport and you just use my car while you're there.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so it's about like, so I went on this, what could have been an extravagant trip for, again, probably about a third, maybe even less than the third of what the cost would have been if I would have paid, gone the traditional way. So it's about, it's not just about the way that you do these things with the resource you're at is you steward the resources in a different way. It's not just paying retail for everything. It's about finding ways to do the same things that others are doing at full price, at a discount, or being okay with a used phone, for example, or Like my vehicle, it looks new because they haven't changed the model in like 10 years, but it's a 9-year-old vehicle. It has almost 200,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
But I haven't had a loan on that car since we were knocking out all our other debt. Actually, I don't have a loan on any of my cars.
Yeah. You know, and like, we never will.
And that's another budgeting practice that I still have a car payment every month. It's into my savings account. So that when the next car comes around, I can also pay cash for it, right? So there's
smart
further principles along that way. So I've never not had a car payment, but the big difference is that I've been paying into an interest-bearing account for probably the last 6 years to pay for the next two cars my wife and I will need. Then we will buy those used, it's because they're so much less expensive. I mean, the car my wife drives, she wanted to buy that car new. I'll never forget this because I told the guy, the dealer was like, what's your price point? I'm like, don't worry about it. And we're fine. And then I saw the price tag when he walked away. And I was like, told my wife, I'm like, I'm never paying that much money for a car ever. So sorry, So a year later, that same car, not the exact same one, but that same model and very, very similar amenities became available with 18,000 miles on it and an extra year warranty beyond the manufacturer because now it's a certified pre-owned vehicle, mm-hmm. and it was half the price of what we would have paid for that car brand new. So it looks like I'm driving around a brand new car because it had 18,000 miles on it, but I paid half the price for it, And so part of it is just about financially being savvy and doing these kinds of things that are different than what the market wants us to do, I think is the best way to looking at it.
Delayed gratification.
That too.
And not having to keep up with the Joneses,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. And sometimes you're going to have a bunch of people calling you now, Michael, or emailing you like,
that's fine.
Can we grab coffee? Yeah, tell me how you find these deals. That's awesome. Yeah. And I agree with you on the, we did something similar with my truck, It's mm-hmm. 12 years old now, 240,000 miles about. It's a Toyota, so it's going to go till 300 or 400.
Yes.
And but it was owned by a commercial.
Got it.
Maintenance on the regular. Mm-hmm. Great shape. I had to fix the transmission, but I got that truck super affordable, no payment.
Yep, yep.
You know, and that's how I always look for vehicles like that. And sometimes guys I talk to, especially guys in their upper 20s and 30s, that's not how they think.
No, no. That's one of the biggest barriers to us qualifying people for home mortgages is student loans are a challenge, but usually it's the car payments. Those car payments are substantial. It could easily be today $600 to $800 for a car payment. We see that a lot.
Man.
So much money.
Yep. Yep. My daughter just got her first car last summer from a neighbor. really funny because she was really interested in it, and he's like, oh yeah, let me look at the blue book, and you know, since you're neighbors, I'll try and give you a discount. I'm thinking maybe around $5,000, and she's tugging at my sleeve like, dad, let's buy it. Mm-hmm. And our deal always was, hey, for your first car, we're gonna go 50-50. So she knows I'm paying half.
Yep.
And she's done a good job with her savings, and she's like, I can do this, dad, I can afford this, I want my first car. And I told her, no, shh, like, we're gonna let him get back to us, because mm-hmm. he said $5,000, but he said he's gonna get back to us and he'll let us know the for real price. The very next day we go over for a little test drive and he goes, yeah, you know what? Is three sound okay to you? And my daughter Izzy almost like jumped up and down, like shouting. She tried to play it cool. Like, see, kiddo, that's how we shop with patience. We're not going to be in a super big hurry. And thankfully she loves it. She doesn't yep. mind. Now she has some friends whose parents got them the cars, not like brand new, but paid for it. 10,000-20,000 vehicle, mm-hmm. You know, and hers is three, but I'm like, yeah, but you bought half of it and it works just as good.
Right.
And you're coming with me to the mechanic and we're going to take care of it. So I'm trying to teach her the value of a dollar, and I'm trying to teach her delayed gratification and budgeting. But it's interesting. What would you say, Michael, are some components of a realistic budget? What does a realistic, healthy budget look like?
It's going to have standards, right? So it's really the kind of to championship your finances is to have a budget, right? And so having an understanding of what the income is, what the expenses are, and making sure that you have all the healthy components that we've covered already, like the tithing, the savings, the investing, and then also the bottom line should be that you have excess, right? That's going into that savings, right? It should at the end, the best spot to be would be my benchmarks for my tithing, my savings, my expenses, and it are not netting at zero, but that we're actually having more that we can even put into savings, right? So having extra money over, which ultimately results from that delayed gratification, from those changes. You know, one of the things that we're talking to people about, and there's not one specific answer to this. So I want to hit on this because, again, with the younger generations, as I'm working through this, I'm an ambassador with an organization called First Home IQ, which is where this money mindset stuff is coming from. And it's a nonprofit that was formed about 8 months ago that's on a mission to help with financial literacy in some big ways. Yeah. You know, so we're using these tools in like for employee benefits and those kinds of things to teach people. And one of the things that we're really learning, especially as a Gen Xer who easily is like, just stop buying that Starbucks, like $6 a day, do the math on how much that is in a year. That's insane. That's a ton of money. And if you look at the time value of money and you look at what it would look like to put that $6 a day into some sort of investment that might return 8% even year over 8%, year,
yeah, 6%. It's a
huge growth over time. Well, the thing is that everybody in the younger generations don't want to hear that. They're like, then it's not that they don't want to hear it. It's just judgy right out of the gate, right? Like, it's not the right words to use for the audience. Maybe there's totally room in the budget for a $6 a day Starbucks. And that's totally cool. I get it. I love it. Like, what I'm learning about all this is that I'm saying things wrong for the audience, if that makes sense, particularly again, the younger generations. They don't want to hear it. They're sick of people like you and me telling them to stop buying Starbucks all the time, right? You know, and it's the reality of the situation. And there's a lot of other ways that we could kind of put that into practice too, right? Of just don't say this stuff. So anything, if the budget covers all things, that's the healthy budget. Because a lot of times we'll come in and we'll be like, well, here's our house payment, here's our income, here's our savings, here's our tithing. And then we're not considering our streaming services, you know, as I'm looking at a TV in the background, we're not considering our subscriptions, you know, like look, just I don't know about you, but some of the stuff in my closet, I'm like, wow, I should probably pause that because I don't need 6 bottles of shaving lotion in my house at any given time, right? Because it's on auto ship and I'm not using it at the same way, right? Because there's, or filter, like we got set up a while back at our house on furnace filters because, you know, you forget about them. They're in the basement. You're not looking at them. And so they would come every 3 months, which is when you're supposed to change them. It keeps the air going, especially for a guy like me with a lot of allergies. But if you just get the shipment and then you don't actually install the filters in your furnace, it kind of wastes the money, right? Yes. And so, and then when it stacks up, so those are like examples, again, in my own life where we're looking at. And every once in a while, I will go back and look at what we're doing and cut things out. Like,
yeah,
you know, the streaming service is a big one. I mean, and those always keep going up, right? So if you're paying attention to, I think when we signed up for Netflix, it was like $6 a month. And now it's probably $15 or $16 a month.
We canceled ours years ago. I don't even know. What is it?
It keeps going up. I think I'm at like double 16 digits? Right now. Oh yeah, definitely double digits. And things like, even like looking at Spotify, there's the same way. If you're going to pay for no ads on that for the family plan, it was, you know, $6. And then 2 months later, it's $8. Like they keep upping it.
I use the free version. My daughters hate that. They're like, Dad, just get the subscription. I'm like, no.
it's more and more expensive, you know. Yeah. And you start paying attention to things. Even the you gotta also reshop it from time to time too, right? Like your homeowner's insurance. You don't just set that and forget it. You have your agent figure it out every year. Because that you can save a lot of money. Yep. I'm thinking of one other thing. Oh, like pest management. We live out in the country. There's always bugs and rodents and stuff that want to come in. Mm-hmm. Every single quarter, they come out and treat, and every single time it's more expensive. So it's, you know, then I'm like, okay, time to find somebody new that's going to do the same thing for less, because you don't just get to auto increase your price.
Right.
I mean, I understand that inflation happens, but at the same time, it's like it's almost like some of these services just expect that every time they come out or every month that they're going to bill you, they just add to it. So you got to watch for that. So that's what a budget has, is it's not set it and forget it. To get back to the main point of your question on a budget, is it has to be set up, and then you have to review it regularly to make sure that your expenses that you wrote down when you did the budget are in fact not changing, because otherwise that residual will be there.
That's a good reminder for me. So we started budgeting about 5 years ago or so. And, what I want to do, because I oversee that mostly, what I want to do is on a quarterly basis, I want to sit down with Claire, show her what it's looked like the last couple months, and ask her to help me in terms of, let's think about decreasing expenses, increasing revenue. So what can we cut? Like, let's just analyze open up the bank statements, look at everything over the last couple months, over the last 60, 90 days, whatever. Hey, what's this? $3.99 for Apple. You know, okay, let's find out what that was. Is it reoccurring? Can we get real nitty gritty with it?
Yep.
And just for 20 minutes, analyze what can we cut? Yep. And spend another 10, 20 minutes. Okay, how can we increase? What can we do with our business? What can we do with our saving, investing to increase? And it's been a while since I've done that. So, but yeah, I agree with you. What kind of percentages would you give talk to me like, I'm 25, because I wish I started doing this when I was 25. Giving about 10% is a great aim, right? Tithing. Saving, another 10?
I would do another 10 for sure.
For saving?
Yeah. And that would be probably a minimum if you're looking at savings and investing for retirement, right? Because a lot of people today don't have a pension. So it might be even more than that when you're looking at it, because you might be investing with your 401k, for example, if your employer has that, maybe you've got a match of something. So you max out your match. That's typically all I'm going to do, is max out my match. And then I want to control the rest of my investing. So I don't ever put into my 401k more than what my employer will match. If my employer is matching, say 0.5% up to 3%, that means I'm putting 6% in, they're putting 3% in, and that's the end of it. I would never put a dollar more in that. In most situations. Now there's tax strategy here. Talk to a CPA. Sometimes it would make sense to do that, because that's still pre-tax dollars. So there's some wisdom in those situations.
But we're just talking simple,
basic simple budget. Stuff. Yeah. And you know, the CPA would help with that. Personally, though, there's other ways to do it with you're like a Roth IRA to a certain income extent, because that can be post-tax dollars that you can invest as well. In my space, I have the 401k maxed, as I was saying, like not maxed as in how much I can actually put in, but just based on the match. And then the rest of it, I have my financial professional invest for me. And that's another thing to keep in mind. I mean, my financial person, I pay him dollars every year to invest. He doesn't get a single he's not paid on a percentage. So most financial planners today get a percentage of assets under management, and they make a ton of money doing that, especially as you grow, where my guy, he gets a fixed dollar amount from me every year, and he's just expected to grow it as much as possible. And if he doesn't, he knows he's not my guy anymore, right? Yeah. So there's people that you can figure out that way. And while I have to pay him, like, it's actually money out of my pocket as opposed to just kind of siphoning it off the top of the investments, it's been a very good move for that way. So again, thinking about things differently, looking at what the norm is, researching, knowing what you're getting into, not being sold, but just being that informed consumer. So, but the one thing about the budget that you brought up that I love is making sure that it's not just one person, especially in a married household. Both people need to be involved. Yeah. My wife has no idea about the finances unless I tell her. I manage that. I would love for her to be able to do it. But in my house at home, when I grew up, my dad made the money and my mom spent it, you know? And so and then when she would spend money on stuff that he didn't agree with, there would usually be a little bit of contention, exactly, a little bit of headbutting, and that would create some challenges there. So, but before we move off from the budget, I don't know if you have other questions I want to do, but I want to point out about a tool. So on my website, it's closewithmichael.com. That's closewithmichael.com. In the resources area on that website, there's a download center. And that download center represents has a link to a budget that we update from time to time. So it's near the bottom of those resources, but you can't miss it. It's just called Home Budgeting Made Simple. Feel free to just grab a copy of that PDF. It's a 5-page budget that'll walk you through the simple steps of building one.
Awesome. I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you for that resource. Michael, especially given your line of work, is all debt bad? And how much debt is too much?
All debt is definitely not bad. You know, for people that have a home mortgage, particularly on a primary residence, that debt can actually be super helpful. So it's not just about a home though. So debt on an appreciating asset, whatever that may be, is not a bad thing. If it's a depreciating asset, however, it's not necessarily wise. And if it's not associated to an asset at all, it's really not wise, right? And so let's kind of break that out into what it is. So typically debt on an appreciating asset, the most common one is, of course, a home mortgage in the United States. That's homes are, if you go back to 1942, there's only been less than 10 years in that entire data set where home values declined. It's crazy when you think about that.
Say that again.
Back to 1942, we have data on home appreciation or depreciation back to 1942. So we're coming up on over 80 years.
80 yep. some years. Yeah.
So of those years, less than 10 of the years, home values have declined. And the reality is that if you take out the housing market decline, that was the housing crash that caused values to crash back in 2008 and a few years after that, if you take that data set out, the worst loss we ever had was 1%.
Wow.
So homes are never guaranteed to appreciate, but the data is quite clear that they will always appreciate, with a few exceptions, one of which was the extraordinary housing crisis, which was created by three things. A lot of people believe it was just loose lending practice. Everybody blames the lenders all the time. And that was, I believe, the tipping point. But leading up to that, that was one of the three things. But I think that that was the tipping point, or what really caused it to happen, because what had also happened was household formations dropped by 50% 2 years in a row, and builders were outbuilding demand for about 8 years leading up to that as well. So we already had an excess supply when the demand chopped due to the household formations and birth rates.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, always absolutely.
Economics 101. Yep.
It's total economics 101. And the third thing was, the thing that really caused the excess supply was the foreclosures that we all have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and so we look at market today, you know, in 2024, and still some people think the values are going to fall. And the reality is all three of those variables are the exact opposite of what they were back then.
They look way healthier than they did in 08 and the several years preceding it.
Yeah, they're polar, just like they were then, but in the opposite side. Yeah, it's a big part of it. So you know, let's just go under the extraordinary assumption that homes will continue to appreciate as they have since we started tracking data, with one exception relative to a very weird time. And then let's take that next step. So what about a depreciating asset? That's a car loan. right now with rates the way that they're at, you might be paying 6 to 10% on a car loan on a, and it's losing value faster than that. Yeah. It could be even higher than that. Right. So you're looking at like the value is depreciating faster than the interest that you're paying on it. So you're actually losing double digit money, if not, you know, like even into like the 20% range, particularly in those first couple of years on a brand new vehicle, that is happening because you're paying high interest and losing the value of your asset at the right. same time. You can go upside down on a car in a hurry, especially if you finance the full amount.
Yep.
And then that last one is debt that's not associated to any sort of asset, which is pure consumer spending. Yeah, it's a credit card, yeah. right? And so for me, you know, that was my story. I think it was $89,000 and some change. I don't know. It was close enough to $100,000 to consider it $100,000 in credit card debt that I had to pay off in my story.
You told several months ago.
Yep, exactly. And that's unsecured debt. That is, there's nothing to show for it except a fleeting moment of joy or happiness would be a better word for it. Like that pleasure of, right. of whatever I bought, whether it be a thing or maybe it was an experience, whatever that might look like. But I bought it on credit because I didn't have the cash to do it. Like,
and I'm surprised at how many people will put reoccurring payments and subscriptions on their credit cards when they don't. And that's fine if you already have your 6 to 12 months rainy day, you got a budget and everything's figured out and you're doing it for the points or whatever. Yeah. That's a different strategy. There are people who don't even have any rainy day savings. They're mm-hmm. living paycheck to paycheck and half of their subscriptions or more are on credit cards and their credit card debt is going from 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 grand and they're not even 30 yet.
Yeah.
Those stories break my heart. And so I love that you're bringing up the credit cards.
It's a big part of it, you know, and even now, you look at where you shop online, when you buy stuff online, you can actually, there's services that you can make payments to, you can buy like a pair of pants, you know, $100 pair of pants and pay so many payments of $15 a month to these companies and you're paying them interest and all that as well. I mean, it's yeah. just, that's the thing where it's like, it gets really easy to stretch your dollar when you start to leverage it. But eventually the bank comes calling.
Yeah,
and it can get, it's really yeah. ugly, right? So that's part of the reason why it happens is because it's too easy. It's so easy. I mean, the first thing I experienced when I went to college, my first day of like walking into college, it's illegal to do this now, I believe, but it happened when I was in college, was like there were 3 or 4 credit card companies handing out credit card applications at the orientation for my freshman year of college.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. You already got student loans starting. Let's get a credit card right. started too.
I believe that that's been outlawed. I was told it was, but I haven't verified that. But that's like that. Like, let's just your first year out of the house. You're like you're barely making any money, and you want to live like you lived in house and just keep getting, you know, with parents and get the finances.
So I didn't get a credit card until I was, I think, mid-20s. Yeah. Couple years out of college.
And they're great tools. Like you said, if you're using them to get the points, I told you I went on my trip with miles. That's how I did it, right? Yep. Play that game the right way and you can get a lot of stuff for free, but you got to do it the right way.
And you pay it off. Don't wait to pay it off, yeah, right?
There's
don't
never let, been a dollar of interest paid.
Because, I mean, what is typical credit card interest, Michael?
Oh, over 20%.
Right? Usually. I was going to say 19, but it's over 20.
Yeah, I think everything is over 20 right now. Even the cards I use, but as long as I pay it monthly, it doesn't pay it off. It doesn't have interest.
That's right. Yeah. You pay it within right. 30 days or right. whatever. Okay. Let's try and do some rapid fire here. So some of these last questions. Biggest mistake you see people make with their finances. I think you kind of touched on this by not having a budget. Do you want to elaborate on that? Are there any other really big mistakes you're seeing?
Yeah, I think if you kind of play with what we've already talked about, you'll see there's some warnings that we've get. And so you've got the budget. The other thing that would be in there is just paying retail for everything. There's ways to do that, you know, and nobody wants to be that haggler. Like, I get that. I don't want to be that haggler. And nobody wants to be haggled if you're a business owner, right? And I know what that feels like. You're like, I don't want to work for free, right? My point is being okay with something that's different. Like I said, nobody would know that this phone that we've already talked about was a used phone unless I told you. It doesn't look like a used phone. It doesn't matter. The same thing with cars. It doesn't. So find ways to make that money stretch further. If you're just paying retail price all the time and especially buying stuff new that doesn't need to be bought new, you can spend so much more of that money that you have. And I would argue you're not being a steward of the resources God has given you when you're doing that. Sometimes you're forced to.
Yes.
You know, there are certain things where you cannot buy in a secondary market. You cannot buy them used. You have to pay full price. And then in many cases, they're like, the prices are set by the manufacturer in some cases, right? Like if you want something or need something, and that's another thing to keep in mind, mm-hmm. we haven't talked about I caught myself. I said, you want something, and I'm realizing anything that's in my brain was a want, in fact, and not a need that like came to my mind, right?
Yeah.
So like if you need something and you can only buy it new, then do it. If you want something and you can only buy it new, but you have the money in your budget to be able to use that, that's what discretionary spending is in mm-hmm. part of a budget, then do it. But at the same time, that discretionary money can go a lot further if you can stretch it by not necessarily buying it new all the time. I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting a little confused in my own conversation here. But at the end of the day,
shop around.
That is to shop
compare
around.
Compare prices. Be willing to be frugal. Get the used instead of the new. Yeah. Delayed gratification. Maybe it'll be cheaper in 6 months. Do you really need it now? That there are all sorts of questions that if you just prayerfully pause for a second and reflect, you can make each dollar go a little farther.
Absolutely. One of the things that I do is I usually start a list of stuff that I might be needing to put into my life or wanting to put in my life, depending upon what it is. In some cases, like the smartwatch I have, I wanted this particular watch. And so I put it on my list and I waited till the Black Friday sales and bought it and got $200 off of it just by waiting. So that delayed gratification, I'd identified in the summer that I wanted it, waited until Thanksgiving time to buy it just because I knew it was a want, not a need. So put it on the list. Stuff like that, that always goes on sale during those times, right? So we just wait.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Just all a little bit of waiting.
Yeah.
Well, as Tom Petty said, waiting is the hardest part.
It sure is. And, you know, in that same moment, we need to make sure back to our kids that that's how it's happening. Because I know particularly with one of my, it's kind of funny because the psychology of money seems to show that most people's relationships with money are formed around what their life was like in their house when they were seven. And so I look at my daughter who was 7 years old in the throes of the housing crisis. Mm. When money was extremely tight, I had realized that debt was out of control and that I needed to change everything. And she is, and if you're hearing this, Maddie, I love you. If she is, she's cheap and she knows it. Like we're like, Maddie, like, wow, you know, she can make some money stretch crazy. She has not worked during her freshman or sophomore years of college during the actual school year, just in the summer and in the winter breaks. But she has not ever asked us for a dollar. Mm. She has covered her own expenses. You know, I mean, of course, we're helping her with the money that we had been saving for many years to cover tuition and room and board, right? So we're helping her with that. But outside of that, she's making a couple $1,000s last the whole thing. And that means she's paying for her own gas. She's driving where she wants to. She's hiking what she wants to. She's just very frugal when it comes to that.
Nice.
Now, on the other side of that, my son, who is 7 years old, when the mortgage industry was doing very well, he has a different relationship with how it works. And so it's very, you know, and that's partly because of we didn't know at that time that we were, you know, that's the thing. Like if you got kids that are under seven, be aware of this around that like 6 to 8 year range that you're not just getting them whatever they want or need in time because it's easy and why not? They're just a kid because you're forming some really lasting habits or mindset issues that we did, you know, with that way where Eli he struggles a little bit more with it. He's learning, but it's a hard lesson when you're like, this delayed gratification is a real thing. You have to save. You have to do all this. Like we've worked with him in many different ways to help him understand, like, this is a big deal. To the point where, like, you don't get to drive the car anymore until you have X dollars in the savings account because we need to show that buying stuff all the time is just not the right way to do. You know, we've gone through a lot of lessons, and he's grown so much in it. But I'm sure if you ask him, he'd be embarrassed that I'm saying this, first of all. But secondly, he would be very keen to tell you it's been tough because it's changing some like deep rooted things that were in his mind from, you know, 10 years ago in his case. Right. So that's an important thing to understand about that too.
Yep. Yep. I love that. And I love you bringing in the role of the father in the house to pass that on to the kids in wise biblical ways. tell me, Michael, can money buy happiness? This is a fun question. Talk around this a little bit.
Yeah, so I think it's funny, and I'm going to totally contradict myself here, because I told you at the front end the very big mistake was that money can't buy happiness. And I actually have really come to the spot in my mind where I believe that money can, in fact, buy happiness, but it's about identifying quite differently what the definition of happiness is, right? So happiness is fleeting. It's very momentary. Yep. It's not about contentment. It's not about joy. And so there's a proverb, and I'm looking it up right now. Sorry, not a proverb. That's another one I was looking at. But Philippians 4, 11 to 12 is about learning to be content. And this is Paul, of course, writing this. He says, I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. Those are two huge differences, right? With nothing or with everything. I've learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little. And so, yes, money can, in fact, buy happiness. For a big chunk of my adult life, I said it could never buy happiness because I felt like it couldn't. But ultimately, that was a vocabulary issue, an understanding of words. Money can buy happiness, but it can't buy contentment. It can't buy joy. And that's what we want, if we're honest.
Hey, there you go. I like the way that's a great answer. Thank you for saying it that way. I agree with you. And I think my journey has been similar to yours. Years ago, I would have said, no way, money can't buy happiness. But now I look at it like, wait a second, if you define your terms with a little more clarity, of course money can buy happiness. Are you telling me that if someone gave you $1 million right now today, no taxes, no catches, no strings attached, you wouldn't be happy today? I'd be very happy today. Mm-hmm. But that is not the same as in a consistent, everlasting contentment and joy, which cannot be found in money. And that's where we go, like you and I have both seen, guys who live very simply, they don't earn a lot, they don't have a lot, but they're what we would call quote unquote happy, which is really, they're content. They're, mm-hmm. They have a sustaining joy. They're fun to be around. They're, right. And they're grateful. And I've seen guys who are multimillionaires that are miserable. Their marriages suck. I don't like being in their homes. It's not that restful kind of presence to be around. They're not very encouraging, and they have tons of money,
yep.
Right? So happiness, if you define it correctly, which is based on circumstances, a feeling, usually it's a moment by moment thing. Of course, money can buy, you know, money can buy happiness, but is happiness what you're really after?
Right.
Not that happiness is even bad. I mean, it's okay, but it doesn't sustain.
Right.
So I like the way you've answered that. Would you agree that you've seen guys with a lot of money, a lot of wealth, and they don't have contentment, they don't have joy? And have you seen guys who the world might say, that's low income, they're not wealthy, but they're joyful, they're content?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Both situations. And that you see that. And in fact, because of the way the world is, the funny thing about it is sometimes you run into guys who are very wealthy who also happen to be very content, and they're driving around in a simple car. Like to the outside world, you would think that they fall into that second category of people you described, because we're just judging them by the stuff they have. Yep. Yeah. And the way they behave, we're almost like, oh
yeah. But I love that's kind of my goal. Like me and Claire, we want to be there. That the Lord would bless us with the ability to find all our joy, all our contentment in Christ alone. Mm-hmm. But to still be hardworking and wise stewards of wealth that builds and grows for the purpose of blessing and being generous and helping others in mm-hmm. the world. So it also reminds me of how what I said at the beginning of this episode. How often misquoted 1 Timothy 6:10 is. It's money is the root of all evil. Money is the root of all evil. No. Actually, when you read that Bible verse, that's not what Paul is saying. He's saying the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil.
Absolutely.
Have you heard that misquoted many times?
Oh, lots of times. Yeah. People are almost sometimes afraid of it.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you go back to the parable that was in, Matthew 25, it's in my version, the NLT, it's called the parable of the three servants, but sometimes it's called the parable of the three talents. The third guy was afraid of the master more than anything that had left, yeah. But I think he was also afraid of money in some fashions as well because of that same concept.
So, if you're not familiar with that parable, the master gives his three servants something to invest, right?
Something to take care of while he's traveling. Yep,
yeah,
exactly.
Something his to
wealth,
take care of.
Wealth money.
5, 2, and 1?
Correct.
Yeah, the one with 5 invested his money and doubled it. The one with 2 did the same, invested, doubled it. The one who got 1 talent buried it in a handkerchief.
Yep. And then gave it back.
And then gave it back to the master. I knew you were a hard man, so I buried what you gave me. I didn't take any risks with it. I didn't invest it. I didn't share it. I didn't go out there and do something with it. Here's it back.
Yep.
And he was called a wicked and lazy servant.
Correct.
Whew.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and one thing to keep in mind about that, the way you pitched it here, or not pitched, but just described it, is that both doubled their money, right? A lot of times we look at it, though, is because the Bible doesn't say doubled their money, it's implied, right? So we look at it if we're reading that parable, we see the guy with 5 got 5, the guy with 2 got 2. They both got the same response from their master.
They yielded the same percentage of increase.
Well, they had the same percentage back, right? So they both did double it. So it's not about the 5 or the 2, it's about the percentage, right? Like, that's what we have to always look at.
Yeah.
One did, in fact, get more to invest than the other. Both, though, doubled their money, which is the same impact. In fact, it would be crazy to expect, or even would have been extraordinary, if the guy with 2 had somehow gotten 3 back instead of just 2 more, right? So what, take 2 to 5? But that's not what the story said. But they both did, in fact, get the same percentage back, which is what's important. So someone who has a lot will get more dollars back when they do it, like this guy did, right? He had 5, let's just call it 5 bags of silver, 5 bags of gold, 5 talents, depending upon the version that you read. He got 5 of those back. The other one got 2 and got 2 back. So the total of 4 or 10, it's 100% in both cases. And they both had the exact same response from the master, mm-hmm. which was, well done, good and faithful servant. And then while you did well with little, you'll be trusted with more, you know, in eternity in that example, right?
Yeah.
So that's something else to keep in mind, is it's different dollars. If we look at it only in dollars as opposed to percentages, or bags of silver as opposed to percentages, we can sometimes feel sorry for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's something to just keep in mind as you think about that passage.
You're right.
And read it.
You'd only feel sorry for yourself if you started comparing to others, though.
Correct.
Right?
Exactly.
Because how much would you have had if the master didn't give you anything?
0.
You'd have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Don't compare what God entrusts to some people versus what he entrusts to you. Take what he entrusts to you, because he's entrusted something to everyone.
Correct.
And go out and use it for his glory.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have much time, so I want to honor. You got about 5 minutes here. I'm going to wrap these last 2 questions into 1,
okay,
and let you take it in whatever direction you want to. So the questions are, what role does money play in living a successful life? And as Christian men, what should our view of money really be?
So success is a tough one, right? That's very much subjective to the audience. Like, what does that look like? Okay. I think as a Christian, if we mix the two together and bring in the Christian men about our view of money, we should be looking at success very differently than it is about dollars. I believe a healthy view of money for anyone is that it's a tool, right? Mm. Christian or otherwise. It's a tool to utilize well, right? We don't pick up I know tools, right? We're not going to pick up a crescent wrench and try to take a pipe apart, right? Like, that's, you know, we're going to use a pipe wrench for that, right? There's two very different tools. And I think money is a tool that we utilize for different things. Mm-hmm. We have to, first of all, utilize it to support the kingdom. That's what we're called to as Christian men, right? So if we're using it to support the kingdom, if we're growing our areas, and we're actually using it as a tool to move our lives for ourselves and our families and others, mm-hmm. forward, right? In the kingdom and all of those kinds of things, then we have created what would be a biblical version of a successful life.
Yeah.
Right? So there's no greed involved here. There's joy when you're giving that tithe. You're looking at it the way that you described earlier, that God gives us 100%. I'm super grateful to be giving back 10%, which is a very different mindset than I have to pay 10%. Like, if that becomes legalistic, that becomes, I'm doing this for all of the wrong reasons, when really it's a heart reason that we have to be giving, right? We have to be joyful about it.
Yeah.
We have to find joy in being able to use the tool that God has given us for its most best use, its bestest use. Yeah. So I think at any point, you know, that's where I'm trying to go with this, is that it's a tool. We have to use it for what it's designed for, which is a very complicated question. We've talked a lot about things today, but at the end of the day, if we're using it for what it's designed for, it's going to be a pipe wrench on a pipe or a crescent wrench on a faucet, you know, on some sort of hex, right? Like that a nut, like that is, they're designed for that. And that's what money is designed for as well, to be used as a tool. But usually we look at it as our security blanket. We look at it to define our identities and our success. We look at it to provide comfort in short bursts, you know, in that happiness that we were talking about earlier, that kind of thing. It's not a tool for that stuff,
right?
But we use it that way. So it's a tool. In Christian men, we should be using it for what it's designed for, not for these other things that we can also use it for.
Yeah. And I've noticed among Christian men in my walk with the Lord over the last 20 some years, there's a pitfall on two sides, I think, of a healthy biblical narrow road.
Mm-hmm.
One is a little more obvious, and that's, you know, idolizing money, being really greedy, being like, you know, Scrooge, yep. Like these caricatures of like money is their everything. And they almost worship it, and they usually have a lot of it, and it's all about, you know, their status and their success is defined by it. There's another pitfall that is like, well, money's bad. Like we just misquoted 1 Timothy.
Yep.
Like money's the root of all evil. Oh, we don't talk about money at all for any reason. Like, and it's a secret thing, almost with a sense of like, shh, hush, hush.
Yep.
And we avoid it. And I don't like either of those. I think it's a ditch or a gutter on either side of a healthy, narrow road, which is what you said. Money is a resource. Money is a tool. Money is a blessing when you steward it wisely and rightly. Money needs education around it.
Yep.
And there's a gratitude when it comes to money, and a generosity and a tithing, and there's a wisdom around money when it comes to saving and investing and budgeting. So that's why I wanted you on this podcast. Take us out with you talked a little bit about what our view of money should be. What would you recommend to two different people? This can be our outro. What would you recommend to people who are struggling with their finances right now and are more on the side of like, oh, I'm ashamed to even talk about it? Because you deal with people like mm-hmm. that almost every day, I bet.
Yep.
What would you recommend conversely to people who are wealthy right now and they have a surplus and they're doing well?
Great. So the ones that are struggling, they have to be willing to talk about it and talk to somebody that that knows. Like it's this, a lot of times we have, you know, that silence, that shame, we don't want to talk about it. It is what it is. I mean, for me, it was very freeing to just be willing to admit that I made some huge mistakes, you know, and I've done this in other areas of my life too, where it's like, let's just don't make this mistake again. Let's talk about it, you know, and that helps. So we have to first acknowledge that it is a mess. We maybe are there already, mm-hmm. and then start talking to somebody about ways to do it and realize that you don't get to this ideal version of what a perfect budget looks like. I mean, there isn't, I don't think, a perfect one, but you don't get to that. It's a journey. It starts and it's a plan. It's a roadmap more than anything of time. You know, you look at my journey from going from all that debt to being debt free aside from my mortgage. That took a long time. It took a lot of work, and the Lord blessed me through all of that process, and he taught me so much through that piece. And I did some research, but at the end of the day, for me, I had no excuse. I mean, I have a degree in corporate finance and international business. Like I'm trained on money, yet still made those mistakes because of the heart issues, right? Like that's ridiculous. But I could tell you many examples in my life of where I learned things the hard way.
But now that part of your story is a source of blessing and encouragement to so many people. All and right. I hope people listening catch this. Like Michael just didn't like, oh, you know, it's easy. It's always been easy for me in creating wealth and stewarding finances. It's been a very smooth, easy, upward ascent of blessings. Like, no, go listen to his story around New Year's when he first came on the podcast.
It's literally the exact opposite of that. Like, it should have been all the things you just described, but instead, because I'm a knucklehead, it didn't, right? Right. You know, there's no doubt about that. And the same thing, I tell people this even when we're talking about investing in real estate. Like, the house that I sold to buy the house I live in now, if I would have kept that house, it's worth $250,000 more than what I sold it for only 9 years later. Like, why did I sell that? We make mistakes, right? Like, that's $250,000 in just holding onto that and renting it out. And I probably would have cash flowed too. But so even people that, my point in sharing that piece right there is like, even people that are like experts and stuff still make mistakes, but we learn from them and we grow from them. And that's a big part of it. And tell people, like, I'm so frustrated. Not really. I mean, I'm just like, wow, that was foolish. Like that I didn't save the, you know, we're getting multiple offers. The values are probably going to go up. Cause even then when we sold it, we were getting multiple offers, probably should hold on to it, but I didn't, you know, like wild. It's just, it is what it is. Hindsight's always 20/20, right? And then the person who is wealthy, you know, that's where they've, in those situations, that's awesome. Also, it requires a bit of a heart check to make sure that the generosity is where it ought to be for the blessings that are there. Is the generosity commiserate with the dollars that are there? If it's not, there's something missing. Are we buying happiness or are we content? And let's be honest about it. Like, really honest with ourselves. Are we being are we happy? Are we content? Which one is it, right? So, and one other thing, I'm going to pop a surprise on you here, Adam. And one other thing is that I think we all need to understand very clearly, and something to chew our heads on for a different day, maybe even a different person to talk about this. I don't know. But money is a variable resource that we're all given based on whatever happens and what we're called for in life. Time is a fixed resource that we all have the exact amount of every single day, right? So they're both resources that we're given as gifts. You know, and by fixed, I mean on a daily basis, right? Like my life is going to be a different number of days than somebody else's. That's the variable piece, but let's just look at it on a daily basis. Money is variable on a daily basis based on whatever our wage is and changes over time, and time is never variable on a daily basis. Yeah. And so every single principle that we've talked about regarding money also needs to be applied in our lives to the time that we have. And if we can become experts at managing the time, I think it becomes easier to manage the money.
I think you just picked the topic for the next time you come on the podcast. That's really well said. Yeah, time and money. Everything that you can apply to money, you should be seeking to apply to how you steward your time.
Correct.
Well said. And with that, we'll end our episode. Michael, thanks so much for being on today.
Thanks for having me.